League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hello and welcome to another WTF1 That Time When podcast, the show that takes a look back at some of the weird and wonderful stories in Formula One history. I'm Jess, I'm your host today, and I'm again joined by the wonderful Dan.
Hello.
There we go. You were like, do I speak now? And also by the wonderful Tommy. You're both wonderful.
Both wonderful, thanks. That's a lot nicer than when Matt does it.
I'm a nice host.
Yeah.
I like my guests to feel very comfortable and loved. Good. So today we're going to be talking about that time when three drivers set identical pole position times for the 1997 European Grand Prix at Jerez.
That's going to be a long title. Might need to edit that slightly.
Yeah, we might have to find a condensed version of that.
That time when 121.072.
There we go. He knows the time off by heart.
So obviously we're looking ahead to the Spanish Grand Prix this weekend. This was actually the European Grand Prix of that season, if I'm not mistaken.
No.
So let's just set the scene for everyone listening. What was going on in F1 in 1997?
This is where me and Dan talk for like 40 minutes because it's like, I think you're the same as me, that it's one of your favourite seasons ever.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, one of my first.
Quite a strange season.
Yeah, a really bizarre season. Very different to what it is today. I remember it being quite random. I remember it like yesterday. Well, I don't. But it was a very mixed season. There was a lot of midfield teams doing really well. I was actually amazed that I looked this morning at the results because I seem to remember a lot of midfield teams getting a podium. And if you think that this season, it's very likely that we're probably only going to get Ferrari, Mercedes and Red Bull on the podium and no midfield teams. 1997, you had Williams, Ferrari, Benetton, McLaren, Jordan, Prost, Sauber, Arrows and Stewart all getting a podium.
Nice.
Which is pretty crazy. Panis was a title contender at the start of the year, and a Prost. Fisichella nearly won a race for Jordan. Damon Hill almost won a race for Arrows, which we won't talk about because it's too depressing. Just a crazy, crazy season.
Yeah.
And why was that? Sorry, Dan.
Well, there was sort of a number of factors. It was kind of 97 was sort of the end of a long period of regulation stability. So obviously a lot of teams had sort of converged on similar solutions. Some of the top teams were going through periods of changes. So Williams had lost Adrian Newey towards the start of that season. He'd left Williams and he would start McLaren the following year. Ferrari was going through its rebuilding phase with Schumacher and Brawn and everything. McLaren were getting on top of their new Mercedes engine partnership. Well, it was their third year of it, so it wasn't exactly new, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Williams were sort of like on a bit of a downward slope while Ferrari and McLaren were catching them up.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And I guess Benetton as well, they'd just gone from Schumacher like winning championships and they were sort of slowly slipping back down a little bit.
And you also had Bridgestone coming in as a tyre manufacturer. Mm. So before that it was just Goodyear, and then Bridgestone came in and obviously new tyre manufacturer, the only teams that are going to gamble on that are the midfield teams. Mm. And when it turned out that Bridgestone tyres were actually really good at certain races, that created opportunities for those midfield teams.
I think my favourite weird stat about 1997, which I don't think will probably ever happen again, is that the two title contenders, which we'll talk about soon, went down to the final race separated by a single point. They didn't share a podium for the entire season. They were never on the podium together, Schumacher and Villeneuve, which imagine like that happening nowadays. You would never
Yeah, it's one of my favourite stats in the history of F1, that I think. It's absolutely crazy.
So let's lay the scene. So the European Grand Prix actually was the final Grand Prix of the season, right? And it meant to be in Portugal, right? At Estoril.
Yeah, they did the end of the season, near the end of the season anyway, in Portugal every now and then. And there was financial troubles, was it?
Yeah, the track was sort of running out of money and needed repairs and things like that.
So I think most of our audience will know Jerez as more of a testing sort of track, yeah, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, it was... I don't actually know how last minute it was that they put it in.
Well, I think Estoril was supposed to be before Suzuka, and then when I think it was mid-season sort of time that they realised that, oh, Estoril's not going to happen. And then they put Jerez in at the end of the season to give it a bit more time. And also I think there was pressure from Renault because it was their final season as manufacturers. They wanted the season to finish in Europe so they could celebrate it. So why it was pushed to the end of the season.
Okay. So here we go. Last race of the season. What does that world championship table look like? How close is it at the end of the season?
Yeah, I think there was more controversy. I don't know how much you want to go into kind of before, but they're separated by 1 point. Villeneuve and Schumacher. Yeah. And Schumacher was 1 point ahead?
I believe he was, yeah.
Yeah.
Because
there was controversy in the race before at Suzuka.
Yeah, yeah.
Where Jacques Villeneuve was disqualified and then not disqualified and then did get disqualified again.
Yeah.
Which basically set up this title finale between the two of them. Already it's quite controversial, and you know, it set up this title finale between the two where they were separated by a single point going into the last race, and everyone pretty much assumed that, you know, it's going to be a case of whoever wins this race wins the title.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot is potentially resting on qualifying then.
Yeah, yeah, and Jerez as well. If you don't know, it's not exactly a track known for its overtaking. It's very tight, very twisty. There's very few straights. Lots of fast corners.
A bit of an old school.
Very old school, yeah.
Track, yeah. Not your like Baku or China with a 2 kilometer straight where you can get a slipstream.
It's kind of like Hungaroring, I suppose.
Yeah. So pole is super important.
Okay, so here we are in qualifying. How on earth do multiple drivers set the exact same qualifying time?
Yeah, it's such a weird session. So I actually watched it on YouTube because I found the session on someone obviously recorded it on an old VHS or something. And Villeneuve, so back in qualifying, I think we mentioned it before on this podcast, for those that don't know, this was when you had 12 laps. So you had four runs to get your qualifying lap in within an hour. And the first fastest time to be set was Villeneuve, who set a pole of 1 minute 21 seconds 0.072, and that was 14 minutes into the session.
So a quarter of the way through.
Yeah,
the session.
That's quite
through.
Unusual in itself, because normally in those sessions the faster times would come in the dying minute, so it's quite unusual.
Yeah, it was a really weird session because the reason they scrapped that qualifying was because people would just wait till the end because that's when the track was best.
Yeah.
Villeneuve didn't improve for that entire session, which was very bizarre. But not as weird as half an hour into the session when Michael Schumacher, his title rival, was on for a really quick time, looked like he was going to get pole. Crosses the line and sets a 1:21.072 as well, so exactly the same time, which was pretty mad.
So in those situations then, for those that might not be aware, how do you decide who... Well, actually, that's not even the end of it, because with 10 minutes to go...
Yeah, Frentzen, 10 minutes to go, Frentzen crosses the line. He's looking like he's going to get pole, which would be pretty dramatic. And Frentzen sets a 1:21.072 as well, identical. Like for two drivers to do it is unheard of, and I don't think within the time that we've had the 3 points, if you like, recording it that specific, it's ever happened. But for three drivers to do it is absolutely insane. And there's videos of Murray Walker like absolutely losing it during this all happening, and one of the funny things that when Frentzen sets his time, it cuts to Michael Schumacher, who's in his garage watching it on a monitor, and you can just see him laughing. Like, he's just like, I cannot believe this is happening.
So again, like, let's dive into that then. How, what are the theories behind it? How did that happen? Was it a glitch? Was it, you know, just that they managed to get to that level of accuracy in terms of matching each other's times? What was going on?
Well, drivers setting the same time is, it's uncommon, but it does happen. Like, but generally down the field, I think it might have been last year, I think there was a case where it happened between two drivers on the cusp of Q1, and whoever sets the time first is deemed to be ahead because they set it first. So even though they set the same time, it was the case of someone going out in Q1 and one going through to Q2. I think, I can't quite remember, but
yeah, it does happen every now and then, like fifth and sixth, you set identical times. But yeah, I should probably say that Villeneuve was on pole for the race because he set the time first. So whoever set the time first is essentially pole.
Yeah.
Schumacher set it second, so he was second, and Frentzen was third.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it is such a weird thing, because I guess if you're cynical and are one of those people that love a conspiracy theory, you think, okay, so these two drivers are separated by a single point going into the last race. There's all these jokes, you know, that like Bernie liked to make the championship nice and close and make it a big spectacle, and suddenly these two champions going into the final race of the season have set identical times. Like, what? Like, I just cannot believe the chances of it happening. You would believe that there was a timing glitch.
You've got something like that happens, you do question it.
Which actually, I was, when I watched it back, one thing I didn't realize at the time and hadn't seen written down much anywhere, the timing monitors did actually go down at the start of the session.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And yeah, all the monitors in the commentary box went, and Martin Brundle and Murray Walker were like, they're going to have to stop the session because, like, we don't have any information, don't know what times the drivers are doing and stuff. It was only for a very short period of time. But again, it sort of adds to that conspiracy, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Makes great headlines, that's for sure.
But I saw you wrote an article on it not too long ago, that the teams obviously have their own telemetry and can check the exact times anyway.
Yeah.
So there's no, like,
no real
the team,
way to fix it.
Yeah, the teams will know that it wasn't fixed.
Right? Yeah, on the grid walk for the build up when Martin Brundle, in his first year of commentary, so early Brundle grid walk, he was sort of slightly suspicious too, I think, because he went down to Williams and asked the team for a telemetry overlay of their laps, and they gave it to him, and it showed that in the first half of the lap, Frentzen was up half a second on Villeneuve's time, and then had like three or four corners where he made mistakes and dropped it down, and it did go back down to even at the end. So certainly but then you question whether the telemetry is genuine or not, but certainly from that, you can't obviously overlay it with Ferrari because they probably wouldn't have given television that knowledge, but
no. But
it seemed like it seemed genuine.
So there we go, we've got three drivers with the same qualifying time, and as we've pointed out, that it's set in order at which they set them. So we've got Villeneuve on pole, followed by Schumacher, followed by Frentzen. What happened in that final race then? Should we quickly dive into that race? Because it's quite a controversial one.
Yeah, if qualifying was mad enough. The reason that we did the qualifying as this sort of the main topic is because a lot of people know what happened in the race. And for those that don't, it was the infamous Michael Schumacher move where Villeneuve was catching Michael Schumacher.
So Villeneuve lost pole
early
on in the
race. Yeah, Schumacher took the lead at the start.
And Michael Schumacher was leading, Villeneuve was catching him, and obviously, as we know, because there's a point separating both of them, Villeneuve has to pass him to win the World Championship.
Yeah.
Villeneuve comes down straight, takes the inside of probably the only overtaking spot on the track.
Yeah.
And Michael Schumacher turns in to him.
It's not just a turn in though. It's sort of Villeneuve's coming, and then he sort of gets out of the way and he thinks, oh no, I'll just turn in, and turns in, and it's probably one of the most deliberate contacts.
Yeah, like people, you can see. So like people, the theory is, and I don't know if Schumacher's ever admitted that's what he was doing, but people were pretty certain this is what he was doing. Similar to 3 years earlier, obviously, he had a similar incident with Damon Hill where there was controversy of him winning the title, and he saw his championship going, essentially, and thought, well, if I damage his car and we both don't finish, I win because I'm a point ahead.
Yeah.
But instead, he crashes, goes off into the gravel trap, and Villeneuve carries on. And then, obviously, you had the controversial end where you didn't know if he was damaged, because obviously if his car was broken and he had to come in the pits and retire, a bit like Damon Hill did 4 years earlier, Schumacher's won the title.
Yeah, I think at the time, as soon as it happened, Martin Brundle in commentary was sort of figured, oh, Schumacher's done that on purpose, and said straight away, you've hit the wrong part of him, my friend. Because Schumacher's front wheel only hit the side pod of Villeneuve's car and not the wheels or suspension or anything. And then when he kept going afterwards, it was, oh, well, there's nothing going to be wrong with Villeneuve's car. But then he started to slow down quite a lot, and he got slower and slower until the last couple of laps when the McLarens were right on his tail. Yeah.
That car is actually in the Williams Museum that we've been to before, and they've kept the
damage
on the side pod. Nice. So, like, the Schumacher's tyre rubber, essentially. But yeah, because this race wasn't controversial enough, the ending was controversial. In fact, during the race, was controversial as well. So there was a moment where a Sauber, back to Murray Walker's and Brundle's amazing,
Fontana.
Yeah, amazing commentary. One of the Saubers they were coming up to lap the Sauber. This is when Villeneuve was right on Schumacher's tail, going for the lead. Fontana in the Sauber Ferrari, we should say. Lets Schumacher past and then chops back in front of Villeneuve and loses. He must have lost like
four or five seconds.
It's a
good amount of time.
It's a lot of time. And obviously, you know, Murray Walker made, I think he says something like, a case of champagne to Norberto Fontana from Ferrari. And then Brundle says something like, Murray, what engine is in the back of that Sauber again?
Oh, you are a cynical old chap.
And and then it came out years later that Jean Todt, who was the boss of Ferrari, denies this still and is now FIA president, so he won't admit it. Sauber, the Fontana, in an interview said, yeah, Ferrari came up to me and said, you will block Villeneuve for Schumacher and help him win the title. So,
well,
yeah.
So anyway, the race comes to an end and Villeneuve...
More controversy.
Yeah,
even more, because Villeneuve is slowing down. He knows that all he needs to do is get a point to win the title. Was it a point or 2 points?
2 points, I think.
2 points to win the title. So he didn't need to win the race. And the McLarens were catching him, obviously because of the situation, Villeneuve is not going to risk.
A battle with Hakkinen and Coulthard.
Yeah, they're not going to risk a battle with a McLaren because, you know, he doesn't need to win the race. All he wants to do is finish, get the points and win the title. So on the final lap, Hakkinen's closing him and literally Villeneuve pretty much just stops on the straight and lets Hakkinen go.
And then Coulthard goes past as well.
Yeah.
And then on the finish line, as Villeneuve's about to cross the line to get a podium, Gerhard Berger is like a couple of tenths away from passing him for third as well. At the end, he's just slowed down by so much, which is, at the time, it was like, oh, his car's very damaged, he's just taking it easy. But then afterwards, there was reports that it was a bit more sinister than, well, not sinister, but there was more to it than just Villeneuve going slowly with a damaged car. Because apparently Williams and McLaren had met up before the race, and there was allegedly an agreement between the two where if McLaren didn't get in Williams's way and sort of aided them against Ferrari, they would aid McLaren to win the race.
Well, well, well.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it? It's essentially, so like, you know, people joke about Ferrari, you know, playing tactics with their midfield teams. It's almost like you've got this situation now in F1, haven't you, where a lot of teams have a B team.
Yeah.
You know, Toro Rosso are gonna when Red Bull were leading the title, everyone was like, oh, well, Toro Rosso are going to, you know, block and get in the way and things like that for to help Red Bull. But yeah, these were two top teams that were essentially using the other teams in the midfield to help their challenge. And I should probably say as well, this was Häkkinen's first Grand Prix, first Grand Prix win. And it was just a ridiculous situation because they allowed Häkkinen to get ahead of Coulthard.
Yeah.
So they swapped him, which already just proves that he was Ron Dennis's favourite.
Yeah.
swapped him and then said, like, right, Häkkinen, you go after Villeneuve because we could win this race. And then obviously Villeneuve, as soon as Häkkinen's near, drops back. But yeah, there was all this, you know, I guess it's like match fixing. Like, where do you draw the line of the fact that they're playing with the race result like that?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there was talk of even like Williams, they could be disqualified.
I think
from the title.
I think Schumacher's before the race, apparently Max Mosley had gone up to the Villeneuve and Schumacher and said, if there's like, we won't tolerate any, like, if there's any suspicion of contact that's on purpose in the race, then there'll be severe penalties.
Which there was,
because apparently, well, because there was 94, which you already mentioned, between Schumacher and Hill, and then in 89 and 90, Senna and Prost had collided to decide championships, and I think the FIA were a little bit fed up that this was becoming a bit of a pattern where drivers could do this to win championships. But during the race, apparently Max Mosley said to the stewards, is there going to be any penalty for that? And they said, no, it's a racing incident. But then days after the race, they investigated it again and decided to disqualify Schumacher from the entire championship standings at the end.
Which is, that's not just like a race disqualification. That's an entire season. You might as well have not have even taken.
Yeah, that's
part.
A big penalty.
He kept his race wins though, right?
He kept all his results. It was just he wasn't second in the championship.
Second, right.
Which, yeah, that's a strong message. I mean, yeah, is he the only driver that's been disqualified from the championship?
The only driver, Tyrrell, were in 84 because they were running underweight cars and doing all sorts of shenanigans.
But in terms of like something a driver has done to be disqualified from the entire championship is pretty, you know, pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, the Williams and McLaren thing, it was the sort of thing that there would be suspicions of, but you could never really prove. So I think they
a bit like the Sauber and Ferrari one as well. Like, how do you prove it? Like Jean Todt saying, no, we didn't.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, it could have been his own choice.
Mm. Yeah. So I think they sort of dropped that as a pursuit because obviously the Schumacher thing is controversial enough, and you don't want, when the sport's already in the spotlight for negative things, you don't want to add to it with other things that you can't be sure about, really.
Really crazy end to such a controversial season. It's one of such a controversial race. Like, absolutely bizarre, mad season, which I'm sure there'll be a few races that we'll do in this podcast as well.
And one that Villeneuve isn't really over because as recently as Tuesday he came out to say, to actually blame the young F1 drivers currently competing have actually learned a lack of respect, and he's blamed that on Schumacher's behavior throughout his career, because I guess Schumacher is lauded as an absolute F1 legend, you know, the most successful Formula One driver in history. And because of that, you kind of get a bit bleary-eyed, I guess, about any of his indiscretions, you know. I mean, I guess the thing from my perspective, when I think about Schumacher, he was unapologetically ruthless.
He pushed the boundaries in every single area.
Exactly. Yeah, but he didn't try and hide the fact that that's the kind of driver he was. Whereas I think there might be other drivers of recent times that have, I don't want to say tried to hide it or tried to make out that they're like nice drivers, but actually they're pretty ruthless, but you know, they don't really own it like Schumacher did. And whilst I agree, you know, I personally don't like ungentlemanly or unsportsmanlike behavior on racing, it's still racing, and I guess it's I don't want to say it's part and parcel of the sport, but I think that competitive edge or that absolute desire to win, and you know, I'm definitely not condoning, you know, smashing into each other, or, you know, well, who wants to win a world championship from somebody else, you know, causing a collision and retiring? Or I mean, that's just not what I would imagine a race win should feel like, ought to feel like. But yeah, Villeneuve still talking about it to this day.
I would agree to some sense. I mean, there was a time in Formula 3, this is before Formula 3 took over GP3, I was watching some of those races and I was thinking, like, these kids are literally like chopping each other down the straight. Like, there's no respect to the, like, racing etiquette. Like,
there was an F3 race at Monza a few years ago where they actually cancelled the weekend because the drivers just couldn't drive properly. So they just said, no, we're not doing it anymore.
Like, it's great that, like, you know, Senna had that mentality of, like, I'm coming through or we're crashing.
Yeah.
Schumacher kind of had that. And now
you're not coming through because we're crashing.
And, like, Verstappen is without doubt building that reputation for himself now of, like, never admit it's his fault. Like, that's the reputation he's decided to build, like, his almost like his personality within F1.
Yeah.
It's like, to the point where, you know, even Hamilton's like, I'm not going to race this guy because, and that's obviously working in his favor. But, you know, if you get like 20 drivers on the track like that, which was happening in like Formula 3, you're just getting to the point where, you know, you can't overtake because someone will literally rather crash into you than be overtaken.
Yeah, Villeneuve actually said in this article too, it was to a Swedish newspaper called Expressen. I've probably said that completely wrong, but there we go. He says, you know, he looks at Formula 2 and Formula 3 and he's actually really surprised that we don't have a couple of deaths every year because of the way, I mean, it is Villeneuve, and he is a bit, you know, over the top. But there is one driver who is absolved from Villeneuve's judgment. Any guesses who that driver might be?
What's that? Sorry.
So he says that there's one driver on the grid currently who he thinks is still a gentleman driver.
Hamilton?
Yeah.
Lewis Hamilton. I was going to say Maldonado. But,
no. he says Lewis is great because so far he's done nothing that is beyond the boundaries. Apparently. There's a big difference.
Fair.
He's more of a gentleman on the track. A quick driver, but he's clean. Now, but in his younger days, Hamilton wasn't always clean.
No.
But I don't know if that's like young...
I think the fact that he is up there in the number of titles with Senna and Schumacher and is yet to win a title by ramming someone off the road. Yes, like, people berated him for, like, Bottas moving out the way of him and stuff. And, like, I mean, at the end of the day, that's a team decision. That wasn't Hamilton going on the radio, like, I need these points. Get him out of the way. And even if it was, like, that's part of the game. Like, until Hamilton literally, like, takes Vettel out or does something really, really controversial.
Yeah.
Like, I think the fact that I can't remember anything super...
No.
I mean, he edged Rosberg off the track a couple of times, but that's just standard racing. Everyone
but
does that.
Wasn't it Hungary where Nico literally just didn't turn... Like,
oh,
and
Austria.
Yeah.
Austria.
Oh, it was Austria.
Yeah,
that was it.
Yeah.
And kind of smashed.
So they had
into
a few
him.
Moments, I guess.
But it wasn't. I think you're right. There's fewer immediate instances that spring to mind, I guess, when.
Where Schumacher and Senna, like.
You can name
no
a number
doubt,
of them.
Unbelievable drivers, two of the best of all time. No one can deny that. But. If you ever need an argument against them, it is that they took someone out to win a world title. So, that is always the forefront of their mind. So,
kind of a interesting little aside about gentlemanly conduct, very off topic, but in 1981, it was Carlos Reutemann versus Nelson Piquet for the championship, and Reutemann was ahead in points. And before the race, I think a journalist said to him, oh, well, you can just ram him off. No one will know, and you'll win the championship. And he said, but I would know. So, and he didn't do it.
Wow,
and lost the championship. So,
there you go. Controversy abounds. So, that brings us to the end of this That Time When podcast. Thank you very much for Dan and Tommy for
as always,
fountains of knowledge about Formula One. I always enjoy these so much. I learn so much about the history of this sport when I get to talk to you guys and geek out a little bit. So that's always a pleasure. Thank you ever so much for listening. If you are listening to this on any of the audio and podcast platforms, please do remember to give us a follow, subscribe to this podcast, and also to give us a rating. It really helps us out and helps us spread the podcast further so more and more of you can enjoy the content that we're making, and we massively appreciate it. So thank you ever so much. And we'll join you next time for a podcast around the Monaco Grand Prix.
Yeah,
there's not much to do about that, is there?
Ooh. Oh, no, we've got a good one. We've got a good one.
Thanks ever so much for listening, guys, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
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 Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.